G'day folks, and welcome back to Stick With It, APA's podcast for its pilots. Today we're going to explore in greater detail the concept of industrial negotiating or bargaining. We understand that our members may feel that they are worth a certain value or should be rewarded in a certain manner. But is achieving this a reasonable expectation? In the case of Qantas's 690 short-haul pilots, can negotiators get every pilot everything they want? To help me explore this topic, I'm joined by Matt Warburton, APA's Head of Legal, who recently recorded a podcast with me about the Fair Work Commission and intractable bargaining. And we're also joined today by Peter Raffles. Peter is a qualified mediator and conflict resolution specialist. He's also a former lawyer and commercial pilot. He has consulted with APA, providing negotiating training for our volunteers for many years. So welcome to you both.
Thank you.
I've viewed industrial negotiations as a playing field where we're actually one of the competitors. APA's negotiators aren't the umpires and they don't write the rules. So can you provide us with some insight into that playing field, for want of a better term, and the rules of engagement relating to any EA negotiation or bargaining?
In any negotiation, there's always going to be a tension between creating and claiming value. Sometimes the creating value process is called collaborative, and where people are looking to cut up the cake or split the value that's been created, it's called competitive behaviours. Technically, there's some other terms that are used, integrative and distributive, but that's, by the way. The EA context today has a long history, in Australia. We can go back before the turn of the century, where the bargaining between the shearers and the aristocracy landowners, ended up in a war called the Shearers' War. In 1901, there was a conciliation and arbitration power built into the federal constitution. And in the words of Justice Higgins, it was a new province for law and order, and that conciliation and arbitration would replace the barbarous and very aggressive war, really, between the combatants and to enforce peace, but in the interests of the community. And from 1901 right through to 1990, that power was the norm, and the bargaining was around the creation of awards, and they were industry awards, not in any particular company. One award would cover, for example, today, and still sit in the background, Qantas, Virgin, whatever. But in 1990s, with the increase in global competition, the Keating government introduced enterprise bargaining, and that is that at the enterprise level, the parties would sit down and work out how they could work together and make Australia more competitive. And so we've come through that period, and today we're in a new period, still with international competition. So the blend of bargaining at the table is always a blend of collaborative and competitive behaviours. And where do you create value? And then the process about how you cut it up. The question comes up in a negotiation sort of tactical point of view. Do you compete first and then create, or do you create and then compete? It's very hard to compete and then go back to create. And so the process is, work together, create value, and then find out what's a fair deal for everybody.
Matt, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I would look at it as in a pragmatic way that the players on the field are the companies, various unions in aviation. There's always, typically more than one union involved. And then there's sub-players, the members of the union and obviously the employees of the company. And so, you do those negotiations in a framework, a legislative framework, which give various parties levers to pull. And I guess my job as head of legal is to look at those levers and provide advice about which levers the members of the union and the pilots may choose to take.
Now, I know that many unions across the nation over the years have adopted tough talk, fiery rhetoric, bluff and bluster. Now, I know that whilst they may behave that way publicly and in their communications to their members, is that style of behaviour practical to take into a negotiating room?
I guess a bit of a focus then there is, the tough negotiator, the tough talk. What does that actually mean? The head of Rio Tinto was once described in the press and taking over a new project that he was a tough negotiator. His comment in response was he hated it because it stereotyped him, and he said, negotiation is about working and getting out what you want. And that's it. It's don't get mad, don't get even, get what you want. And that means that it does take time, and it does take a patience and working with the other party and being unconditionally constructive. Yes, you might run into some walls. Deal with it.
It seems to me that, Matt, that the banging of fists on a table or arms in the air in the negotiating room, which is what it might look like externally, bringing that into the room, is that a realistic way of getting something out of the other side?
The problem with rhetoric, if you're going to use a rhetorical style of negotiation, is that in the industrial scenario, you don't get anything until you make an agreement. So the rhetoric makes it harder to make an agreement. You can go in there and you can bang your fist all you like, but the benefits only get delivered to members when an agreement is reached. And so even unions that engage in industrial action, which of course they are entitled to do, they know that at some point that industrial action has to come to an end, an agreement has to be reached, or otherwise there's no benefits. So you've got to think about how you will play that out as a negotiator, in my view. And you might at one point pull from your back pocket some rhetoric, because it's the key time to do that. But it's a one-trick pony. You can only do it once. Once you've done it, it loses its power. So, you know, from my perspective, I'd be very careful about using that as a tactic within negotiations, because it makes it harder to agree at the end.
Because I'm guessing as well, as if every time you walk into a negotiating room, you bring a baseball bat, that clearly has an impact on the ongoing relationship, doesn't it?
Absolutely. We can sort of break negotiations down into a number of different types. And if you're buying one off of a car online, or going to a car yard, it's a one off the relationship. Maybe there's warranty after it, but most times you're not going to see it. And so the haggle when the competitive becomes more the model. Where you've got an ongoing relationship, whether it be, for example, in a retail lease or in the workplace where you've got an EA, the relationship is ongoing, and there'll be shocks like there was with COVID. And so in economic terms, they're called economic shocks. And so negotiating through that and working with the relationship through that is quite a different process. To start with, it can get down to the competitive stuff towards the end, but basically it's one of the interests in the negotiation is the relationship.
And Matt, just because you don't talk tough all the time, it doesn't mean that you're not competitive in the bargaining room, does it?
No, not at all. I mean, that's just a tactic, from my perspective. Quietly spoken, carefully chosen words are the best words to use in a negotiation. It's true that IR is typically not a transactional relationship. It's an ongoing relationship, so you absolutely have to consider that. But always, as always, it's not necessarily the only thing you consider. So any relationship's going to be tested from time to time. And whilst you keep in mind that this is an ongoing relationship, that doesn't mean, of course, that you agree to anything. You know what I mean? So it's balancing those two things and using them to get the best outcome that is possible through the negotiation.
So I'm interested as well, I guess the reverse can apply, because back in 2011, when Qantas chose to lock out the pilots, that I think everyone would fair to agree that that's had a detrimental impact on the relationship for years. So the door swings both ways, doesn't it?
Does the door swing both ways? Yes, it does. I mean, that incident that happened in 2011 certainly contextualised the relationship and the negotiations that went on for the next, 2013 years, and it's still affecting it. As is some of the language that was used at the table. You know, walk into the bargaining room, the same gentleman involved, and say, 0, 0, and 1% in negotiation language. That's called anchoring. The lockout's called the BATNA concept. All of those principles and concepts are real in everyday negotiation, and how you deal with it requires some skill and thinking. Yeah.
Now, I've heard the terms interest-based bargaining or potentially putting forward an ambit claim as sort of different negotiating philosophies. Can you explain to us, I guess, the differences and whether one is better than another?
I talked to a little bit earlier on about the history of industrial relations in Australia. The period between 1901 and right up to the 1990s with the award system, very much the discretion in the companies was, well, they're the management, they create whatever it is, and then you come afterwards and you try to cut up the piece of that cake for the employees. And so the whole philosophy of ambit bargaining, the company is, tell us what you want and bargain down from that. That all changed with the legislation and the competitiveness in the economy and the world economy. What we see with enterprise bargaining is people talk about interest-based bargaining. So it's a term that's thrown around, so let's talk about it for a minute. What is interest-based bargaining? Where did it come from? In Fisher and Urey's book, Getting to Yes, it was framed as interest-based bargaining. There were four principles, you know, to separate people from the problem, focus on interests, invent options, and insist on using objective criteria in how you reach an agreement. And so what are interests? You know, if I want to buy a RAV4, for example, and my position is I'm happy to pay $30,000, $40,000 for it. RAV4, $30,000, $40,000. But what's my interest behind buying a RAV4? So my interest, first of all, is it's a Toyota. Am I going to get service and reliability out of it? Is it going to have a resale value? Another one. Is it going to serve the interests of me and my family? So everything that's behind that RAV4 for $40,000 are my interests. So that's what interest-based bargaining in an EA, interests are in there everywhere. Job security, training, the relationship that's ongoing, all of those, they're all part and parcel of the interest. It became then known as principal bargaining, and the BATNA concept, communications, and the process itself were added to the seven-element framework, which today is the principal bargaining framework.
So you just mentioned the word BATNA. I've heard phrases like BATNA, Watner, Zopa, they all sound very elaborate. Can you give us a bit more context as to what those concepts actually are and how they sort of work together in a negotiating sort of situation?
Okay, let's go back to my Toyota RAV4 and the Watner, the BATNA. Let's start with the Zopa. What is a Zopa? The zone of possible agreement. If I know that I've got $40,000 I can spend, and I know that if I don't reach a deal with this person I'm bargaining with, that I will go and buy a similar car for $40,000 somewhere else. That's my best alternative to a negotiated agreement with seller A, is $40,000. The seller will also have a BATNA that they will go to perhaps come down to $30,000.
And sorry, BATNA stands for?
The best alternative to a negotiated agreement.
Right.
So buying that other car from that other person is my best alternative. But the important thing in there to understand, it's the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And in your preparation for any negotiation, you can sit down and think of three or four alternatives, but you pick the best one and you strengthen it. And it might be that I say, well, I'm not going to do anything. One of my alternatives is that I'll just ride my push bike for the next 6 months. It might be good for my family, but it is an alternative. The best alternative is looking at the other car. And similarly for the other $30,000, they'll have worked that out. And if you can know what that is, then you can work with it and attack it, so to speak, and make it worse off for them. But the area between the $30,000 and the $40,000 is called the zone of possible agreement. And so there's an overlap. In some cases, there's a gap, but that's the zone of possible agreement. And the distance between their BATNA and our BATNA, that's the zone. And it's calculable because you can work out the cost of your BAT, even in an industrial context. You can get a fair sense of what it's going to cost to walk to what you think is your best alternative. The Watner concept is the worst alternative. What if I don't reach this deal with this person? The other car's now sold, which I thought was my alternative. Now I'm in my worst situation. Now what am I going to do? So that's what a Watner is.
Okay. So now that we've got a bit of context around those terms, if we sort of tie that back into what we were discussing before about interest-based bargaining and sort of ambit claim, Matt, can you give us a bit more context? Because I know a lot of our pilots, but they like the idea maybe of, you know, just a log of claims. These are the things that we want. Can you give us a bit of context as to, I guess, the pros and cons of that style of negotiating?
Yeah, look, I think interest-based bargaining and log of claims type-based bargaining are really about a framework that you do the bargaining within. The log of claims, it actually has a history. Peter obviously knows a bit of the history. The way that you would have an award made is that you would have a dispute found. And the way that a dispute is found is you'd serve a log of claims across state borders to get a federal dispute. And what that means is that by definition, your log of claims would have to have ambit claims that would set you in dispute in perpetuity. And then the award would be made in settlement of that dispute, right? So there's a very technical reason why logs of claims make up part of Australian IR history. And so it's natural that people go, all right, well, we're going to move into bargaining now and we're going to use a log of claims. And it's certainly one way of doing it. But it doesn't have to be the only way, certainly. And the concept of an ambit claim, whilst, you know, everyone gets the concept of I'll ask for a bit more than I can settle for and therefore I should settle where I want to, the concept of an ambit claim is a concept that was arrived at so that you didn't have to serve too many logs of claims to get the dispute. So yeah, I mean, it's a framework. My experience with both of them is that they're both useful frameworks. I don't think necessarily log of claims is going to get you any better outfit. It depends on the intention of the parties, in my view. If the intention of Qantas and the intention of APA is to breach an agreement with each other, then I think that the interest-based bargaining is a good framework. Because everyone goes, right, we're all in this sort of together in one sense. And so therefore, this is a good framework. If you have a position where the employer is not really engaged in those negotiations, which I don't think is the situation here, then a log of claims may be useful because it brings clarity to precisely what is wanted. Yeah.
So what you've just explained, some of that, is that still relevant in today's industrial landscape or is that more historical?
No, so the powers of the Constitution have changed. They use the corporation powers. So you no longer need to go through that process. It's no longer required. And now we've moved into bargaining. And so, it's good to consider other frameworks for sure.
Now, turning to the negotiators themselves, a common refrain from our members is the call for professional negotiators. Now, you're one of those people, Peter. Why aren't we using you? Or are subject matter experts more important with complex EAs like what we have in Mainline?
I'm going to go back to that question about what's an expert negotiator at the table. Someone might be very skilled in the process of negotiation, bargaining, and where it's happened from the level of trying to build peace between Ukraine and Russia to down at the domestic level. They might bring a lot of skills to the table. But the knowledge of the history of the aviation sector, the knowledge of the history of the relationship is all important as well. So from my perspective, if you're going to go to the table, you build a team, and you build a team with a portfolio of skills, of the knowledge of the past, but also an awareness of what happens at the bargaining table, and that includes historically, but also as you're looking to create value and being able to do that. What I have done with APA, historically, is to provide advice and education about, the process and how to go about it. I think that blend of skills is in there in the team already. And I'm happy to provide further advice, but listening to what's happened over the years at the table and after the work we've done, they're very skilled people that have been at the table.
So you don't think that you would have got a better outcome if you're in the room?
Yeah, it's an awkward question, and you say, well, what do I bring to the table? It is to be able to track the process and to perhaps make some suggestions at different times. But you can do that with a sounding board. The people come in and thump the table better than other people thump the table, as the guy from Rio Tinto says. It a tough negotiator? Well, no, they don't thump the table. They actually work very hard at the table.
And you've seen lots of contracts or agreements. In the scheme of things, it strikes me ours is incredibly complex, or our agreements are incredibly complex and nuanced. So the idea that people that are in the room are the ones that live and work under those contracts, clearly that provides an advantage.
Absolutely. I've been the facilitator in a number of EA negotiations and at one point in my life as a manager on one side of the table. Yes, having the knowledge about what goes on in the industries is critical, but the EAs, for the pilots are very complex, and it takes a lot of knowledge and awareness and skill, of the personal needs of the people, the needs of the company, and the needs going into the future where the market is fairly competitive. It needs that skill at the table and the knowledge, yeah.
So following on from that, Peter, it's almost a bit chicken and egg, in terms of could we, with our pilots that are interested in negotiating, we just keep hammering their skills and improving that? Or is it a case of you bring in someone who's a professional negotiator first and then teach them the contract? Is one better than the other?
It's a difficult question. Let's put that up front. And bringing somebody in is going to take a lot of time. And there's not only the context of what's in the substance of the agreement, but also the relationships that have gone on in the past. The people who are the pilots and who are the agents know the history. And so in this context, my suggestion would be to have someone coaching or providing advice to the pilots as they go along the journey. That would be my leaning at this point, yeah.
Okay. And Matt, I know that the legal team play a supporting role of our negotiators in the room. Can you talk a little bit about what that role is and your involvement?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that enterprise bargaining done by ABA is at the best level. I've worked for unions for the last, you know, over the last 20 to 30 years. And I think having those expert, you know, workplace representatives, which are the APA negotiators, in there doing the bargaining and being able to come back and rely on legal support, I think that's the best model I've seen. It's not typically the model that I see in a lot of negotiations, but in my view, it's absolutely the best model. I would consider myself an expert negotiator, so I've been doing it for 30 years. I know how things work, and I think that the bargaining that happens here at APA is at the best level.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind commenting on that one as well. To have the legals in the room and the knowledge of the law and the shifts that go on from national policy level is just vital, you know, that you need yourself in the room. Absolutely. It's a team thing. That's the point I'm trying to get across. It's knowledge or awareness of the history, the people, the relationships. You need the industrial relations history as well, and, you know, knowledge of working with people.
So what do you think about, because one of the things that sometimes I think pilots can criticise APA for is because it has a relationship with the company, it means that APA's going to be soft in a negotiating room, or it's not going to get the best outcome because it has a relationship with them. But from what you've been saying, that seems to me that relationship's crucial.
It's absolutely critical.
I think that every bargaining scenario has a relationship. It's just about the dynamics within that relationship, really. And I think that you need to tread that, you know, delicate balance of negotiating hard and negotiating for the best outcome of the members, absolutely, but not doing things that are going to cause irreparable damage to the relationship. So that's the balance. And you know, I've got no doubt that the bargaining that I've been involved in here at APA, absolutely, that's the nice line that everyone's trying to walk.
And I think, look, that segues nicely into the next part of this, which is, whilst what you've been talking about, particularly, say, from the company side of it, it's very unemotional and very much a business thing, that because of the lockout and then the history of the past 15 years and the pandemic and the idea of the pay freeze, it's made it incredibly emotional at the moment for the pilots. And one of the challenges is obviously being able to either process that emotion or park it, whatever phrase you want to use, so that you can objectively look at the deal. That seems to be a challenge, and it's quite hard for everyone. Do you have any advice or perspective on that side of things about trying to cut through the emotion to objectively assess the deal?
I don't think that stopping the emotion is a good idea, because I think the emotion drives engagement by pilots, right? I think that that is useful and that is powerful, right, in the bargaining context. But you've got to have that overriding, you know, piece, which is until we reach agreement, we get nothing. So you want to harness that emotion to drive the engagement, but you also want it to consider that we need to lock away the agreement. So if the emotion is stopping you locking away benefits and conditions, then something else has to take over at that point. But I don't think you can act like a robot and go into bargaining and not have any emotion. I think it's actually a good, powerful thing, but it needs to be considered in the context of locking away improvements to wages and conditions.
I agree, the emotionality is core. It's core to our lives, in what we do in our private lives and our sport and whatever we do. It always must be balanced with rationality. Our emotions can get us into trouble, I think, as we know. But how do we bring that rationality and at one point to check what we're actually doing?
And I'll ask a question. One of the, again, the rumour mill is that, you know, we've got pilots that with regard to the pay for reserve. So the concept at the moment, you do a reserve day at home and you get paid nothing unless you get called out. under this deal, it would be that you would get 4 hours pay to sit at home. And then, you know, if you got called out, it's a little bit different. That is viewed by some pilots as a win-win. And the issue for some people that I've heard is because it's a win-win, they don't view it as a pay rise because the company's getting something as well as me. Does that seem odd to you?
It's one item in a whole compact of issues, and a win-win in any part of the getting TS framework is it's win-win. One of the researchers at Harvard doesn't like the frame, and neither do I. I think it's about mutual gains. Is there a gain there for both parties? If it's a mutual gain, then it's hard for me to see why you wouldn't see that as something that is good and valuable for you.
I think that that is one of the main changes under the short-haul agreement. We are ascribing a value to something that previously did not hold a value. And the reason why I think that is a good win for pilots is because that will almost certainly never change now. So you've been able to ascribe a value to that rostering arrangement, and that will be forever now, I think. And so for me, that is a great example of locking away that win and saying, okay, well, let's go for our next route. Or, you know, that's great, let's lock it away. Because I think that that's not something that's going to come and go. I think that will be into the long haul.
And is the concept, is the, because I guess what that then talks to is this broader concept. I think the emotion that is circulating potentially drives a bit of a feeling of we need to win, but they need to lose.
Yeah, zero-sum game. Yeah, absolutely. I'm not a huge fan of the win-win concept because most of the time when I've had that said to me over the bargaining table, it actually hasn't been a win-win, you know. So I think you do well to apply a certain amount of cynicism to someone when they tell you this is a win-win. I think that's a good thing to do. But you don't have to, there's no requirement to punish the company in order to lock away benefits, in my view. You know, sometimes what you win will mean that it's an additional cost to them. That's true. But sometimes what you win, they may be able to deal with without having additional costs. So I don't know, I'd call it a win-win, but I don't think you need a detriment to the company in order to have it be a win.
One of the things I'd come back with, some people might see it as if we get a 10% sort of gain on where we were, but the company gets 90%, it has that win-win. They're gaining much more than we were. Well, what it does is it opens up trading on other issues so that you might get the 90 and they get the 10. You know, it's part of a whole, you know, compact of issues being negotiated. But I can see why some people would say, for example, you know, yeah, we got a 10% increase on what we had, but the company's got a 90% increase. Then how's that win-win? You know, you go, well, it's a mutual gain, but what happens there is it opens up opportunity for other ones to say, hey, we were able to work with you to create value in that. We want attention on this one.
That concludes part one of our chat about enterprise bargaining and negotiation with Matt Warburton and Peter Raffles. We'll be back with another episode, which is part two, where we discuss what happens in the event the pilots vote no to this deal and what is protected industrial action, the pros and cons and considerations. We trust you can join us for that chat soon. In the meantime, fly safe and stick with it.